Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady, or the inventor of the hashtag More Vegetables Than a Vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size, and self-love, and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Valentine, the PaleoMom.com. I'm the New York Times best-selling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip. So, welcome to the Paleo View, everybody. Sarah, last week was not episode 132.
I saw that, and I have to say, I laughed so hard, because it was like the one time since, like, episode 3.
Which is why I'm not allowed to say it. Matt texted me while he was producing the show. He's like, yeah, except it's not episode 132. So, I won't tell you what episode it is, but welcome, everybody.
Well, so, I do believe that this actually is episode 132.
I believe that you're right, but I could probably be wrong. So,
better safe than sorry. Welcome to the Paleo View, everyone, and we'll just start it like we do every single show without saying what episode number it actually is.
Yes. Anyway.
So, you posted a pretty darned epic post this morning.
Yeah, it took, like, you know, a few weeks to write it. As I'm sure you know, between being in the midst of medical diagnoses, at one point I had started that post and it was like, I may have cancer. And then when I went back to write it again, I was like, yay, I can take this out. I don't have cancer.
Hey.
Yay. Yeah, but I was getting a lot of questions and suggestions from people on how to handle some of the health diagnoses and things that I'm working through. And so I wanted to make sure that people understood the full picture of all the information that I had, because quite a number of people were suggesting to me, for example, that I try a intermittent fast or a ketogenic diet to help manage some of the health conditions that I've been talking about. And for someone with my particular diagnoses, that's the opposite of what works for me. In fact, it's what created my initial, what I now know to be a Hashimoto's flare. So, because I don't have a gallbladder to digest nutrients, if I intermittent fast and then eat one or two big meals, I don't have bile storage like most people have over that time period of not eating. So the meal that I do eat, only like 10% of it or something ridiculous is digested, and the rest of it just literally goes right through me. So a high fat diet does the same thing. I don't have bile stores to break down fat properly. So, working with a medical professional, as well as doing a lot of self-research and talking with you, Sarah, and talking with other friends who have some of the medical diagnoses that I have to figure out what works for them. I was honestly surprised that my doctor even tested me for MTHFR. Like, I didn't know that that was one of the things she was testing me for. And when we had our MTHFR podcast, I kind of was like, not even 100% thinking about how it could relate to me, because I just was like, eh, that's something other people have.
Right.
and then I got the diagnosis and I was like, I wonder if I should listen to that podcast.
Well, it's certainly, I mean, as I think I said in that podcast, it's one of those things that I only understand in a very surface way, because when I had my MTHFR genetic testing, I'm wild type, which is the Yay, awesome. So, so it sort of, you know, for me, when I'm researching a topic, I mean, sometimes it's just because something sounds really geeky awesome to me and I just want to understand more about it. But often when I'm researching something, it's motivated by what I'm going through, any particular struggles I have, any particular goals I have, and what I think might help. Like it's very personally motivated. So now you know a lot more about MTHFR.
Indeed. So to summarize, because I have been talking about the health stuff lately, the official diagnoses were that I have MTHFR, I am heterozygous, which means I have both of those awesome things. And I also have the SIGA deficiency that we talked about in episode 85, I believe it is. I have celiac as my, what I believe is my main autoimmune disease, which would link to the immunoglobulin deficiency. And I also have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which I talked about last week. I had a nodule in an inflamed thyroid, but the nodule is benign and my test results and symptoms, except stalled weight loss, are the only kind of symptoms that I have for thyroid that are affecting my life right now. So the things that we discovered, my low liver function is, turns out, very frequently tied with people without a gallbladder. Another thing that they don't tell you when you remove your gallbladder is that your liver and actually a lot of people's pancreas also are affected. So fortunately for me, my pancreas is super happy and my liver appears to be going towards the stages of what could be diagnosed as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, i.e. it's not very happy, but it's not also like, you know, gonna kill me or anything. So what I'm working on is figuring out how to moderate my food intake because I had, as we've talked about on the show before, kind of self-transitioned myself off of digestive supplements because I really hate taking supplements. Like, it's not a thing. It's not like I don't want to take pills because I have some association with, you know, being less of a person. It's not a mental thing. It's just, I always forget them and they're really a hassle and they're kind of embarrassing when I'm eating with people, especially at work, and I have to pull out like 7 giant pills. And it's just, I just don't like them. And I don't like that if I miss them, my body is even more, non-responsive to digestion because they're used to the digestive enzymes. So I weaned myself off of them, and part of that weaning process, I had increased my carbohydrate. Of course, I eat mostly paleo carbs. I mean, I eat some weight race, but honestly, not very much, and usually in post-workout window. So what my test results revealed is that because my triglycerides were fine, actually my triglycerides were great, and my omega-3 fatty acids were all within good to normal range windows, that it just appeared that I was eating too much carbohydrate, which is what the doctor and I are supposing. So we agreed that I would continue to not take digestive enzymes and pull back my carbohydrate a little bit, like 25% of what I was intaking, in the hopes that I can still have good digestion. And I'm on day 4 today, and I'm usually that kind of stuff pops immediately for me, and I'm having no digestive problems with this so far, in the hopes that it will resolve my insulin response and the liver response to the foods that I'm eating. So, I mean, I have classic overweight, high resting insulin and high leptin, which I really hate to like utter out loud, and I had all the shame about it first, and I was feeling really frustrated by it. But, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. I was metabolically broken my whole life, and my body is just really super sensitive to carbohydrate. I wish it weren't the case, but it's not that way for everybody. I mean, most people, 95% of people probably could eat the amount of carbohydrates that I eat and have no problem with it. But for me, even starchy carbohydrate, even, you know, starchy vegetables or whatever is really a problem. So, it's not to say that I'm not still enjoying life. It was interesting for me. Yesterday, Sarah was like, we hosted Matt's birthday here at the house after I was doing this like macronutrient ratio thing. And I knew that we had gotten him a Cheesecake Factory cheesecake last week when we were supposed to celebrate it, but the snow and all that kind of stuff, like the family didn't come over until last night. And it felt a little bit, I'll be honest with you, like Weight Watchers, like I planned my day around when I could eat those macros, you know, but it was like, I have to hit a certain percentage, a certain number of carbohydrates a day in order to like, you know, I made this promise with my doctor, like we try this thing. And if I don't want to go back on pills, I need to like keep that promise, which meant that I had to like do the game where I didn't eat carbohydrates.
You're like saving the points.
I totally did.
Treat at the end of the day.
I did. I saved my carbohydrate points so I could have it after dinner. I did work out yesterday, which is another rule that I have for myself. I try not to eat treats like that on days that I don't work out, because I know that my body responds very differently on days that I work out on the days that I don't. So all of this is just stuff that I'm learning about myself. But the great news is that all of the like really big kind of things that I have, all of the particular diseases and that kind of stuff, the genetic problems that I really kind of don't have any control over, are being managed with diet and lifestyle and some supplements that I'm going to add for mainly just the MTHFR and liver function. And that is attributed to, and in my post, I said probably no less than a dozen times, to following the paleo approach, because I put Hashimoto's in remission without even knowing that I had it because I was following the paleo approach. So thank you for helping me manage an autoimmune disease I didn't even know that I had.
Completely by accident. It took me the whole day, but I did actually read your whole post. I didn't want to interrupt you with the stuff you were saying, but there was like a couple of, I actually took notes of like a couple of things that I wanted to come back to from you just sharing your story just now. One of the things that you mentioned is that you're getting a lot of people recommend that you do intermittent fasting and follow ketogenic diets. And I really want to emphasize for people that there's actually preliminary studies in the scientific literature indicating that those strategies can suppress thyroid function. So if you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, it is the absolute opposite dietary strategy from what we should be doing. At least, you know, there's enough scientific evidence to point to it being potentially hazardous, and there is no scientific evidence pointing to it having any particular benefit. Like, nobody's actually looked at that. And so we do know that insulin is required for T4 to T3 conversion. That mostly happens in the gastrointestinal tract. So we know that the thyroid is very sensitive to insulin and cortisol and these other things that can go up when you're fasting. And we know that you do need some insulin for that conversion from T4 to T3. And we do know that cortisol suppresses the conversion of T4 to T3 and instead encourages the conversion of T4 to reverse T3. And we talked about this, I think, a few weeks ago when we were doing the Hashimoto's couple of podcasts when I first got diagnosed. But I just kind of want to emphasize for people that moderate carbohydrates, so that the thyroid gland is really sensitive to insulin levels. So when insulin is too low, that's a stress on the thyroid. And when insulin is too high, that's a stress on the thyroid. And that's one of the things that's so tricky that Stacey's going through right now, is you really need carbohydrates in this like happy medium range where your blood sugars never go high, but you're getting some carbohydrates. And that can be a really tricky thing, especially for people with histories of metabolic syndrome, obesity, high blood pressure, you know, diabetes or pre-diabetes. It can be really, really tricky to find that happy medium. And I don't envy you having to go through that. Although it's also something I feel like I'm constantly tweaking myself. So at the same time, I kind of get it. So I kind of wanted to mention that. And then you mentioned that you have both the C667T and the A1298C SNPs for the MTHFR gene. But you mentioned that you're heterozygous. That actually means something different than having both of those SNPs. Did you have a test, like, on the page it said heterozygous?
I don't have the page in front of me, but I saw that somewhere.
So what heterozygous means is you have one, so you inherit a copy of the gene from your mom and a copy of the gene from your dad. And what it, a heterozygous means is that you have one copy of the C677T SNP, but the other copy of the gene is C677C, so the wild type. So what heterozygous should mean is that you have, out of your two copies of the gene, you have one copy that has the SNP that reduces the activity of MTHFR, and you have one copy that is the normal MTHFR, which is a pretty good situation to be in, because it, you do have some, if you're going to have a gene variant of MTHFR, to have only one copy of it, because it suppresses, the activity is suppressed of MTHFR, but not as badly as if you were homozygous, which means you have a copy of that less active gene variant from both of your parents. So I just kind of wanted to clarify some of that genetic language for our listeners, because I like science. and because in a few minutes I'm going to go on like a sort of pro science ranty thing, soapbox. And so I kind of wanted to make sure that that genetic pieces of the puzzle is sort of clear for our listeners.
Yeah, I don't know. I need to, I guess, figure that out. All I know is that I did test positive for both. And I honestly had Matt do some Googling based on the information and talking to Jennifer and talking to you guys. So I do have... What was important to me, at least, was that I had normal homocysteine levels, which we talked about, which was an indicator of good nutrient absorption in general on that front. So I'm still taking the methylated folate and B12 in the hopes that that will kind of support liver function and be supportive to my health. But that's kind of the extent to what I know so far. But this is part of the problem of kind of like sharing as you go, right? It would be a lot easier 6 months from now for me to be like, hey guys, I was going through this stuff and it really sucked, but here's all the answers.
But at the same time, I think it's one of the things that people find so frustrating is these like rosy, you know, stories after the fact of, you know, like when you're going through it and it's scary and it's hard and it's, you know, not fun. You know, it's nice to know that that's normal and that that happens to everybody. And I think that it's one of the things that people get really frustrated with is these sort of like, oh yeah, I used to have that. Right. Like it's just, right. Like that is such a, like, you're just like, then you should get it more. But it almost is the exact opposite sort of feeling. Like you just feel like you're being dismissed because, so I used to have that. Yeah, I just completely changed my entire life and now I'm all better.
Like, I mean, I can't even remember what I did, but I did a bunch of stuff and now I'm fine.
That's really frustrating for people. So as much as it's difficult for us to talk about going through health things as we're going through them, and as much as it makes us vulnerable, and it also, I think, for people who don't know us well, has this potential to instigate really unproductive conversations because, you know, as I think we talked about last week or the week before, you get this whole like, well, if you got that, well, you're paleo, then I guess paleo doesn't work, right? And we get these sort of like reactions, and I think it's going to lead into my soapbox really well. I think there's this human tendency to take any evidence around you that supports what you already believe and use that as proof, whether it's anecdotal, scientific, whatever. And I think there's this human tendency to dismiss any evidence to the contrary of what we already believe is true. And, you know, I guess that, you know, that would be called closed-minded versus open-minded, sort of technically. But I think it's sort of the roots of that are deeper. It's not being a closed-minded person. It's having these beliefs that are the foundation of your choices and how difficult it is to assimilate information that is contrary to those choices in your beliefs. And that sort of brings us to the topic of today's show is we're going to talk about exercise, but we're really going to be talking about when exercise is too much and how, you know, doing exercise to that too much level, and I used air quotes there, we'll talk about what that means, how that can actually hurt you and make you less healthy. And the huge body of scientific literature that is starting to understand why. And the reason is that I had, you know, been referencing an old post that I wrote after my presentation at AHS last August, where I actually did an entire presentation about how lifestyle factors impact gut health. And I had referenced a brand new paper that was out last week where the paper was really trying to quantify. So we know that there's this U-shaped response curve to exercise. So if you're sedentary, that's bad. You know, being sedentary increased risk of all kinds of chronic illnesses. And it's, you know, it's one of the worst, biggest risk factors for like anything bad happening. It's one of the worst things that you can do for your health is to live a sedentary lifestyle. But being extremely active and particularly engaging in intense or strenuous activity, and particularly when you engage in those intense or strenuous activities for prolonged periods of time, think endurance training, that also dramatically increases risk for a variety of different health problems and, you know, dysfunctional immune system and, you know, pathologies of the digestive tract. And so there's this like happy medium in the middle where you're really active, and ideally that activity should be tons and tons of like light to moderate activity. And this, you know, has all kinds of health benefits. And so the study that I quoted was trying to quantify that. And they were trying to put numbers on where this U is on average. And they were specifically looking at joggers. And they were specifically looking at this, you know, group of people. It was like some European town somewhere, I can't remember. And they were specifically looking at, do you jog? Do you not jog? How much do you jog? How quickly do you jog? And then does anything bad happen to you? And it was looking at all cause mortality, which is basically anything bad. And they found where the U was in this particular population. So they found that people who were jogging less than an hour a week had all the bad things of being sedentary. And then people who were jogging more than 2.5 hours a week had all the bad things of being overactive. And so that both of those were the extremes. Those were where the cutoff was in that population that increased risk of something bad happening. And it's kind of different. Like the type of things, the ways that your immune system breaks down when you're overactive is quite different from the way your immune system breaks down when you're underactive. There's a lot of different things going on. It's not like you're at the same risk for the same health conditions on both ends of you know, the tails of that U. But neither place is good. And I think that, you know, for us, I think the vast majority of us, we are trying to be as healthy as we can for as long as we can, right? Like we want to live a long time and we want to have amazing health for as long as of that as possible. And so understanding how our choices when it comes to activity are going to influence that equation, I think, is really interesting. That doesn't mean that if you, in particular, go running 5 hours a week that you're like doomed to drop down from a heart attack at any point. This is looking at averages, and this is trying to get a sense of, you know, where the lines are. But it's also, you know, a supplement to an argument showing that other types of activity are better for you if you're going to spend a long time being active. For example, walking, right? There seems to be, you know, no limit to how much walking that we can do that's going to provide us with a health benefit, because it's this sort of light to moderate activity. And where we start to get this U-shaped curve is really when we start talking about more intense activity like running. So I shared this information by, you know, as a way of, you know, linking to this old post that really goes into the details of how intense and strenuous activity can harm your gut. And the mechanisms that we understand in the scientific literature for exactly how that happens. And it really got people's ires raised. Like it really upset people. And I think it upset people because nobody likes to be told that something that they love, especially something that they love and have the perception is good for them, is not as good for them as they think. And I want to make an analogy in this. Stacey, you should tell me what you think of this analogy. But to me, I feel like it's very similar to telling somebody that their multigrain bagel, that their healthy whole grain breakfast with low-fat cream cheese for breakfast is, you know, not a good choice, right? It's a very similar to me, you know, we're so ingrained, pardon the pun, to believe that the healthy whole grains and low fat dairy are really, really healthy foods for us. And it's not an easy thing to explain why that's not a good choice, because you have to take several steps back, and you have to start talking about really some fairly detailed science in order to really give a good explanation of why those food choices are not conducive to health. And I feel like it's the same with overactivity. Right. So overactivity means a different thing for different individuals. It's really, really hard to put a number on it for one person, which makes this really, really difficult. And we are so conditioned to believe that our active lifestyles are these huge victories. And it's really, really hard for us to take a step back from that and look at it objectively and really evaluate, you know, again, it's sort of the difference between being thin and being healthy. And there's a big difference between health now and health over the long term. And, you know, I think that a lot of us can look at, you know, the muscles that we're forming, the leanness, the energy that we have because we're so active, and not really have any kind of understanding of whether or not that's so much as to negatively impact our immune system, which is not something that you necessarily see right away. So go ahead.
Okay. So it's not that I disagree with you. I agree with you in that analogy, but I think that there's something from my personal experience in talking with people that I see. And I think that that is the response that, I don't know if you intend to talk about it maybe in the science segment, that people have from the endorphin rush and positive serotonin response that you get from working out. And that there are a number of people who are really addicted to working out. And I will wholeheartedly admit to you that my body has become used to working out. And that if I don't work out every other day, I start to feel kind of depressed. I get kind of like blah, and I don't, then it's like this negative cycle where I don't want to work out, and then it gets even worse. And then by the time I actually work out, I'm like, oh my gosh, I love this. And I feel so great. And for me, that's a fine line, right? Like I need to watch and make sure that I'm not, having kind of a roller coaster response to the hormones that come with working out. And I think that there are some people who, there are diagnosed medical conditions for people who overexercise, just like there are medical conditions for people who are addicted to either eating or not eating. And I believe that we have a society of people who, because we have this thought that exercise is good, like you described, that it's encouraged for people to, you know, be very, very active. And that can mean something like CrossFitting twice a day, never taking a rest day, never having a deload week if you're a strength trainer, running multiple miles very frequently. I mean, it can look different for different people, but if you feel like you can't live life without working out one day, then it's probably not a good sign. It's probably more of a dependency than you're willing to admit. And I think that it would be beneficial to look into, you know, what those triggers are that could be causing that addiction, because the kind of response that you're describing, Sarah, is the kind of response to someone who, like being addicted to bagels and not wanting to give them up. You also, people who probably are fully aware of the risk to their body of overexertion and the potential risk for injury, the, you know, cortisol response, the multiple things that I'm sure from a scientific perspective you can address that come from overexertion. And those people, probably most of them, aren't completely clueless to that stuff, but they're just, they don't want to hear it and they're in denial because they enjoy the benefits of it. And, you know, I know that I know people that are like that. I know that for me, there was a time where, you know, I used exercising as adjacent to eating disorder or disordered eating. And I've known plenty of people that do that. And so I think in this concept, at least that I have around, you know, having a healthy mindset, that translates into the way that we think of our bodies. And I know that I personally really, really, really want to be strong. But I also know that if I'm in the gym lifting really heavy weight every single day and not giving myself a break, that that can actually do more damage to my body than good. So it's just, it's not that I don't agree with you. I just think that there's more to it than that as well.
I think that's an amazing point. And that's why we co-host this podcast. Because I think that you said very eloquently something that I was sort of failing at saying. Exercise addiction is absolutely a thing, and it's like really well studied in the scientific literature, and it's associated with the exact same biochemical changes in the brain as alcohol addiction, drug addiction, food addiction, you know, cigarette addiction. And that certainly, I think that anybody who's active loves their activity. And I think that whether that crosses over to the point of addiction or not, that love of that endorphin rush, and that love of being strong or being fast or being agile or whatever it is, I think it makes it really, really difficult to step back and really critically evaluate how that activity is affecting our health. And I think what makes it so challenging for me from a, you know, educator's perspective is that it's not like food where I can say, this food is good, this food is bad, this food is kind of in the middle, and you can self-experiment with it in this, you know, sort of structured way. Because when it comes to exercise, you know, there's certainly some rules, right? Weight-bearing exercise is awesome. So anything that moves your own body weight around, you know, anything that's building type 2 muscle fibers is awesome, compared to, you know, we tend to get a lot of type 1 muscle fibers when we're sedentary. And it's the type 2 muscle fibers that are correlated with reduced risk of bad things. But at the same time, I can't say 2 miles of running is the cutoff. So if you run up to 2 miles, you're doing great. And if you run over 2 miles, that's too far, right? Like, I can't I can't say that, right? Because we all come from such a different background and come from different fitness levels. And so what is too strenuous or too intense for one person could be a totally mild workout for the next person. And so, and just because something is too strenuous or too intense, that doesn't mean you can't gradually improve your physical conditioning and work towards that. And I think that a lot of people misinterpreted what I was saying as supporting being sedentary, which it was completely not what I was saying and would never say. But rather that, you know, there are, I would like people to understand that there's negative health impacts of being overactive and encourage people to really critically evaluate the role that their particular chosen activities are having in their life. And that, and to encourage people at the same time as critically evaluating that, what we really know is that light to moderate activity, like doing anything that's not sitting, like walking, like just being up and down off the floor and standing up all day, right? Though that activity is what is really correlated with improved health and longevity. And so I think there's two things happening. There's one that people who, you know, are really passionate about their sports are really passionate about their sports and they don't want to give them up and they don't even want to pull. Sometimes it's most of the time not about giving it up so much as pulling back the intensity a little bit and making sure you have rest days, right? That's what we're talking about. We're not saying quit. We're saying make sure you have a rest day once in a while. Make sure you fuel appropriately. Make sure your sleep is good, right? Like make sure you're recovering before you dive into it again. You know, hydrate smartly. Don't have food in your stomach. I mean, these are things that are discussed actually in quite a lot of detail in the paleo approach. So part of it is that. And then part of it is really encouraging people to figure out ways of decreasing the amount of time in their day that's sedentary, because that's the other side of the extreme. And we actually know in the scientific literature that being sedentary for, you know, 8 or 10 hours, right? Your hour-long commute, your 8 hours at work, your hour-long commute, and then going and doing a really hard workout in the gym doesn't actually make up for those hours being sedentary during the day. So finding ways to build movement into your day, even if that's, I mean, something like a treadmill desk or, you know, those, you know, various, you know, exercise equipment that you can stick under your desk, right? You can get like pedals of a bike, so you can be biking underneath your desk. Those types of things are awesome, but it can be as simple as setting a reminder in your phone to stand up and stretch and, you know, walk around the office every half hour, right? That has a tremendous benefit. So it's a really complex topic. I think it's a topic that's really, really difficult to communicate effectively because there are no hard and fast rules per individual. We're really, the whole point is to ask people to listen to their bodies. And then you're listening to your bodies through a haze of endorphins, which makes it really, really challenging. So I think it's time for you to talk.
All right. So why don't you give us some science on this topic?
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys. So I think that because we're talking about this U-shaped response to activity, it really makes a lot of sense to explain exactly what it is about intense and strenuous activity that can cause a problem. And there's actually a variety of ways that intense and strenuous activity can impact the health of the gut. First and foremost, it activates the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. So this is the fight or flight response, the stress axis, and this is activated anytime we do any kind of intense activity. So endurance training for sure, but also strength training, especially heavy lifting. The more intense it is and the less rest that is built into your workout, the more the HPA axis is activated. Now that produces cortisol. And we know that cortisol has a direct effect on the connections between the cells that form the lining of the gut. And those connections are called tight junctions. And they're a highly specialized, highly controlled structure between the cells. And the cells can actually open and close the tight junctions at will to allow nutrients in. And what happens that's a problem and causes leaky gut is when those cells lose the ability to control the tight junction structure. So we know that cortisol actually directly affects the tight junction structure, but it does it actually in a fairly complex way. So it makes the gut more permeable to small things, low molecular weight substances, but it tightens it up against high molecular weight substances. So it's really changing what's able to cross the gut barrier. But cortisol doesn't just have this direct effect on the tight junctions. It also, because cortisol is part of how the body reprioritizes energy usage and reprioritizes blood flow, because it's part of the fight or flight response. So it's part of making sure your muscles have the energy to move and your brain can do some critical thinking. What happens when you have this cortisol release is it decreases gut motility. So it slows everything down. It decreases mucus production in the gut. It inhibits digestion directly by reducing pancreatic enzyme secretion and gallbladder function. It decreases the blood flow to the intestine, which when prolonged causes something called ischemic injury to the intestine because the intestines are deprived of oxygen. And there's even some studies showing that cortisol may directly affect the type of bacteria that are living in the gut. But activating the HPA axis, cortisol is not the only problem for the gut. And in fact, what's probably a bigger problem is the hormone that is released by the hypothalamus that's called corticotropin-releasing hormone. And we know that corticotropin-releasing hormone has a very pronounced effect on the tight junctions. It actually changes the proteins that form the tight junctions to keep those junctions open. And we know that high corticotropin-releasing hormone increases the leakiness of all epithelial barriers. So not just the gut barrier, but also the skin barrier, the lung barrier, and the blood-brain barrier. And where this gets to be an even bigger problem is in the context of adrenal fatigue or overtraining. So what normally happens in the HPA axis is corticotropin-releasing hormone is released from the hypothalamus. That signals to the pituitary gland to release another hormone called adrenocorticotropic hormone, which then goes and signals to the adrenal glands to release all of the things that adrenal glands release. So that's cortisol, but that's also those wonderful endorphins that we love so much when we're exercising. So then cortisol signals back to the hypothalamus and says, hey, we got the message. We're activated. We're stressed. We're running away from a lion. We're great. And then that turns off the loop. So it's called a negative feedback. And what it does is it decreases the production of corticotropin releasing hormone. So what happens when you've been consistently overtraining, when you're under a large amount of stress, when you're not getting enough sleep, is you get what we colloquially call adrenal fatigue, what is technically called in the medical profession, chronic adrenal insufficiency. And the adrenal glands basically just can't keep up with what the signals going to them should say that they should be producing. So they basically produce less and less and less cortisol and everything else. So what that does is that takes away that negative feedback loop. And the hypothalamus will start producing more and more corticotropin-releasing hormone because it's detecting that there's something stressful. So it's detecting that you're running away from a lion, or you're detecting that you have a big work deadline, or that you're, in the middle of a, 3-mile run. And so you start producing more and more CRH, which has this greater and greater effect on the leakiness of the gut, but this is also why there's such a strong link between gut health and mental health, and skin health. So that's the part that is the stress axis. It's not the only way that exercise directly impacts the health of the gut. There's also a class of proteins that are produced during exercise called heat shock proteins. They're called heat shock proteins because they were actually, they're the proteins that are responsible for causing fevers, and they were first identified in that context. But they're actually a really important part of the immune system, and they're generally really important antioxidants. So they're part of the body's repair process. But heat shock proteins also have a direct effect on tight junctions and can open them up. So again, it becomes a dose thing. So a little bit of heat shock proteins, you've got some good antioxidants that help with muscle repair. A lot of heat shock proteins are starting to affect the gut again. And so we know that there's these pretty intense effects of exercise on gut permeability. We know that there's a few conditions that will actually make this worse. So we know that if you're taking NSAIDs, so things like Advil or aspirin, that that exaggerates the increased leaky gut as a result of strenuous exercise. And we know that performing your exercise in the heat exaggerates these effects. We know that taking a probiotic reduces these effects. So it's a very complex thing, but we know that especially endurance athletes, so runners, cyclists, triathletes, they have, this increased risk of pathologies of the gut, like colon cancer, gallstones, diverticulosis, and inflammatory bowel disease, which is in large part because of how that high intense exercise is impacting the immune system, but also this direct effect on the gut. And so it's really important to understand that this U-shaped curve is not just based on epidemiological studies. It's not just based on correlation. When we're doing science, correlation is where we start. That's where we look. Is there a potential link? If there is a potential link, then we need to go and answer the question, why? How does this happen? And it isn't until we know how it happens that we can confirm that that's an actual link. And this is what people mean by correlation does not equal causation. That is true, but it indicates that there's something really interesting to look at. It's when we can identify mechanisms, such as the mechanisms that we know are the culprits behind why intense and strenuous activity can cause increased intestinal permeability and damage the gut. Once we know those mechanisms, then we can say that that correlation is a thing. That then we can say that is causation, and that A does cause B because we know how it happens. And so that's the really, really important take-home message here, is so that we know that certainly most of these studies are done in endurance athletes, so they're done in runners, cyclists, and triathletes. There's a few studies that have been done in sort of high-intensity interval training style workouts where sort of, high intensity and short rest periods. And we know that parts of this happen in that type of exercise as well. Those have not been studied as extensively. And we don't know if it happens or to what degree it happens in more traditional weight training. It seems to be much lower activation of the HPA axis when you're doing, a set of heavy work and then you're taking a rest. That seems to be a much lower stress on the body than sort of this endurance training, but there's a lot still that needs to be understood where the lines are. But it's an entire field of study, and there's actually a lot of science to show that finding the happy medium in terms of activity is really important.
Okay, Sarah, give me 5 bullet points on really great things that exercise does for you. So not everybody is feeling like they need to just sit on their sofa now.
Okay, so huge benefits of physical activity. So increasing muscle mass increases metabolism, makes it easier to achieve a healthier weight. Regular physical activity helps improve bone density, and it can even not only prevent, but it could even reverse osteoporosis. It regulates the levels and sensitivities of a whole pile of really important hormones. So it regulates insulin and insulin sensitivity, cortisol, leptin, ghrelin, and melatonin. So it can help you sleep better. It can regulate your appetite. It can regulate your metabolism. It boosts your mood because it has direct effects on several different neurotransmitters, and it is known to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, depression, and even cancer. Haha.
And it can make you feel like a superhero.
Yes. It also improves your resilience to stress. I think that's another really important point, because we are getting just as big a picture in the scientific literature of the negative health impacts of chronic stress. And working out regularly actually makes your physiological response to a psychological stressor lower. So if you are a physically fit person, getting stuck in that horrible traffic jam doesn't make your body release as much cortisol as a sedentary person.
Boom.
So this isn't saying don't exercise. This is saying lots of moderate intensity exercise.
Be smart.
Be smart.
Well,
listen
as much,
to your body.
As much as you are referencing your talk at AHS, I will point out that Stephanie Gaudreau and I did pretty much this talk at AHS as well, where we talked about the health benefits specifically for women and the difference between that type 1 muscle fiber and type 2 muscle fiber. So I'm looking forward to answering the question in the context of how I prioritized my working out and how I believe that that's beneficial to my health. And also throwing you under the bus for what you used to do and what I convinced you to do.
I can take it.
Okay, let's do it.
So, questions
and answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
So our question today is from Marinka. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. She says, I used to be a top-level swimmer until getting ME and CFS at 16 years old. It took me 5 years to get better when I finally found a good nutritional therapist and switched to paleo, after which I took up CrossFit. I absolutely loved it and had loads of energy. At 25, I had a bout of severe adrenal fatigue, and while I'm now almost back to normal, I still find myself unable to do any exercise besides hiking and yoga. My gut is healed, my adrenals are back to normal, and even my thyroid levels are improving. I did write and publish a paleo cookbook last year, which is stressful, as you all know.
Really?
Yeah.
we're with you on that one.
I totally didn't find writing books to be, like, the most stressful thing ever, right? Yeah. I'm seeing Sarah and Stacy doing a lot of exercise while you both had serious health issues and lots of stress at the same time in the past and or present. And you have a family. So my question is, how do you do that? How are you able to do CrossFit and feel good afterwards? I would absolutely love to do CrossFit, which is an understatement, but I simply can't. I've tried so many times, but after each WOD, I'm famished and need to recover for at least a week. I'm hoping it's not just that you have superpowers, which wouldn't surprise me, but it would be great if you could give me some advice on this topic. I really don't want to believe I will never be able to do that kind of sports again.
Okay, so I'm gonna lay down a shocker here, and it's a shocker because I've talked about it in the podcast before, and I blogged about it, and actually Melissa Jewelwine recently did an interview and talked about this as well. But CrossFit isn't for everybody. I mean, CrossFit can be scaled for those people that want to do it, but not every sport is for everybody. And so I was doing CrossFit at the same time that we were finishing Relief Paleo, and it was not a good life choice. It led me to have anxiety attacks in the middle of long cardio-intensive WODs. It was also the summertime, which is interesting. Sarah, as you were talking earlier about some of those effects being heightened in the summer, I was like, huh, funny. I likely have had adrenal fatigue this entire time, so it's probably also contributed to that. But for me personally, the amount of long-term intense cardio and strength output that CrossFit was requiring was not a good fit for me and my health. And it's one of the reasons that I switched to just lifting heavy. And I happened to find strongman at the same time. And there are still metabolic conditioning movements in strongman, but they're short bursts. They're usually like 1 to 2 minutes. So it was a lot easier for my body to do that and then rest and recover and then do another set and then rest and recover versus this intense cardio that my body was not responding to, especially when it was for longer periods of time. So that said, last I checked, Sarah, you had not yet gotten your superpowers?
No.
Okay.
I put in an order. I don't know what's taken so long. I got lost in the mail or something.
But Sarah and I both openly talk about being very aware of how much we sleep, how good we're eating, how much our stress levels are, and how that plays into how much we work out. And we talk about that because we want people like Marinka, if we're pronouncing that correctly, to see as an example from us that we're not working out despite the fact that, you know, we have problems. And I know Stephanie Gaudreau has a rule that she doesn't work out if she hasn't slept. I think her rule is at least 6 hours. We all have, she's the paleo athlete, by the way, which is why I kind of associate her with the paleo athletic kind of sphere. But this concept of finding a happy medium is very important. And so for you, it might just be that you begin with walking or you begin with yoga, as Sarah did. It could be that, you know, low intensity swimming, if that's something you did before, could feel really good on your body. That's a low impact exercise that could feel really good. And I think that, you know, not feeling guilty and not feeling shameful and not feeling stressed out about the fact that you tried it and it didn't work. Good for you for listening to your body. Don't continue to push. Don't continue to go. And that's where I'm referencing the Melissa Jewell article. And I'll make sure Monica puts a link in the show notes. But I think reading her story and how she learned to listen to her body, despite the fact that she loved CrossFit and she felt like her identity was tied to it, she was having a lot of health problems and a lot of symptoms when she was done with that workout that indicated to her that it wasn't working. And she had to let go of something that she was really passionate about and didn't want to say goodbye to. But the result was that she felt so much better after she said goodbye. And it could be, I mean, I won't speak for her, but it could be that a time of healing will then allow you, if you want to go back to doing something, to do it. Or, you know, you could find a scaled version of those kinds of movements in a non-cardio intensive environment, which is pretty much what I did, right? Like I took the movements of CrossFit and then I slowed them down and I added more weight, which helps with the type 2 muscle fiber that we were talking about. Okay, Sarah, I'll let you go. I could talk about this forever. I feel very passionately about it, and it is something that I'm constantly aware of with myself. And there are some days where I work out and all I want to do is take a nap after. And that's when I know that I need to take like a serious rest, like 2 or 3 days, you know, and I'm very aware of it. And I happen to be somebody with a thyroid problem and with an adrenal problem. So I have to be aware of it. I can't overdo it or it will crush me. And when I'm on the brink of those things, like that's the thing that I have to give up. And it sucks because that's also the thing that kind of gives me energy and gives me motivation and that kind of stuff. So it's a fine line for me. I don't have superpowers. I wish that I did. But also one of the things she mentions is having a family. And that's, I also talked about the reason that one of the reasons that we opened the home gym was because I missed my family. And you know, they often work out with me, or they pretend to work out with me on the other side of the gym. But it's nice to spend time with them. And instead of, you know, having a sedentary hour or two after I get home from work before they go to bed, oftentimes we find ourselves in the home gym instead. And it's a really great bonding family time, which is also really good for your health. Spending time with loved ones and laughter and that sort of stuff, play in general, as we had Mark Sisson on to talk about a long time ago, is incredibly good for our system. So I've kind of combined two things to help with that for me. You have so many more things you can cover.
Well, so I did start CrossFit last spring. So it's been 10-ish months since I started CrossFit. And I didn't do it until my body was ready. And so prior to starting CrossFit, my activities were generally walking, hiking, yoga, gardening, like the kind of gardening where you move boulders. And then for about 4 months before I started CrossFit, I was doing strength training classes at my local YMCA, which was all, you know, high rep, low weight, foundational strength training type stuff. And I still, when I started CrossFit, there was a really steep learning curve for me in terms of what was good for my body, because my brain loves it. My brain would do it every day. My brain would do it twice a day. But my rest of my body, not so much. So when I first started, I really jumped right in. I wanted to be doing it every day. Like every workout sounded awesome and I didn't want to miss one. And I didn't, you know, like I thought, well, you know, there's one day a week where there's, where the CrossFit box is closed. So that's clearly my rest day. And that was too much. And so about a month and a half or 2 months in, I just hit a workout that I couldn't do it. And I felt terrible. I got teary. I started crying during the workout. I cried more after the workout, and I cried not because of an emotional release. I've had that experience since where a workout allows me to, without even really thinking about it, work through some kind of, you know, stress or problem. And I have this sort of like emotional release afterwards where I cry afterwards, but it's like a relief. That was not what this experience was. And then I slept terribly the next night, woke up the next day with really intense muscle pain. And that to me was like, whoa, okay. So I've overdone it. My body's now screaming at me. And I took 5 rest days. And then I went back more gingerly. But for me, CrossFit was such an important stress reducer in my life that it actually helped me get through my second book. So doing CrossFit actually sort of helped me like stay healthier so that I could finish the Paleo Approach cookbook. But now with CrossFit, I sort of, you know, it is not for everyone, but it can be scaled and everything can be scaled and you can start CrossFit from any fitness level. However, how well it is scaled is completely dependent on the skill of your coach. And there are many, many, many coaches out there who are fantastic at making sure that you push yourself, but not over the edge. So that you're getting a good workout, but you're not overdoing it. And they're really, really good at working with you to figure out if you have an injury, if you have a health issue, if you're just coming from a place of, you know, not being physically active, of working with you and figuring out what is an appropriate way to modify a motion, what's an appropriate weight for you to use and get you to warm into it. Because it's not good for business if you go in and after 2 weeks you injure yourself. So a good coach is going to help you work through that. And what I did was I actually, before I joined my box, I went in and I talked to my coach and I explained, you know, what my concerns were. And I explained, one of my concerns is that I'm a highly competitive person, and not competitive with the people around me. I'm not competitive with other people, but I'm competitive with a standard that I set for myself, and that I really push myself and I drive myself, and that I was going to need him to tell me to pull back. And he's been fantastic at that. Now, all this being said, when I really crashed in the fall, I stopped going to CrossFit. I went about once a week in September and October, and I did not go at all in November and December. And it wasn't until after I started feeling the effects of the armor after my diagnosis in January that I went back. And so, you know, it was great. It got me through the cookbook. But then when I hit the crisis point in the fall, especially with all of the traveling in early November, I couldn't go anymore. And I stopped going. So for me, it's really important that I'm sleeping well. It's really important that I don't have any joint pain. Joint pain for me is a big indicator that I'm overdoing it. If I have severe muscle pain, always give myself a rest day. If I'm having mood issues, that's an interesting one, because sometimes if I'm having mood issues, like, there's nothing better than CrossFit to fix them. But sometimes I'm having mood issues because I've been in CrossFit too much, and I try to recognize where the difference is. So things that I recommend that people look for is muscle pain. So a little bit of stiffness the next day isn't normal, and especially when you first start. When I say, if you're first starting an exercise program, if your muscles are sore, you should not go back until they stop being sore. So the first day that I did my strength training class over a year ago, that was before I started CrossFit, I couldn't straighten my arms the next day because my biceps were so spasmed. And so I didn't go back for a week. It was 6 days or something like that was when I went back again, because that was when my arms didn't hurt to straighten anymore. And so so that, I think, is a really good rule of thumb. And I still follow that rule of thumb. I'm very rarely sore the next day. I might have a little bit of stiffness, right? There might be a little like, ooh, stairs feel good right now. But if I'm really sore the next day, then that has to be a rest day. If I don't sleep well, then I have to have a rest day. That's one of my earliest symptoms. Food cravings for me are always a sign of stress. Second winds in the evening are always a sign of stress. If you have autoimmune diseases, so any size sign of those diseases coming back is, you know, clearly a stress. And so I think that with CrossFit, and especially coming from a place of chronic illness, it requires finding a great coach, finding a really supportive, a really supportive box. So the other members of the box are like really supportive, encouraging people, and not like super competitive. And that just sometimes, even within a box, it requires like going to classes a few different times to find your people. Having really open conversations with your coach and really, really listening to your body. And so I think it's awesome. My coach is trying to talk me into registering for the 2015 CrossFit Open, which I think I probably will do, since the open WODs are going to be on one of my normal days anyway. So I'll end up doing them anyway. So I might as well sign up for the open. But for me, I'm going to be really proactive over the next couple months to make sure that signing up for the open doesn't change how I'm tackling those workouts, and that I'm continuing to listen to myself. And one of the big things I've done since going back in January is not doing that last whatever. So if we're doing back squats and it's now do as many as you can, I it was one of my other coaches says, you still had one in the tank. I'm like, yep, I'm keeping it. I'm saving it for a rainy day. I try to hold back. So I try to go until it's hard, but not push that last one. Whereas I used to like, you know, scream loudly enough to scare the children for a 3 mile radius. And that is only a slight exaggeration. I'm really, really loud at CrossFit. you know, and I'd basically like scream the barbell up. Like that was how I got it up of whatever the, or down, whatever the motion is. And now I don't push myself to that level. And it's actually made a huge difference in terms of, you know, how I feel afterwards. So I think, I don't think that with chronic illness, that means we can't do something like CrossFit and we can't do sports. I think it means we have to be a lot smarter about it. And I think, you know, similarly to how things like activity level and stress level and how well you're sleeping really impacts how well your body tolerates sort of gray level foods, I think it's the same with activity. So, you know, when you're getting good quality sleep and your nutrition's really good and your stress is really low, that makes it easier to have sort of these higher, more intense activities in your life, keeping it smart and keeping it below that line and not crossing that line. But it's sort of, it's one of those things that, you know, when you're talking about coming from a place of chronic disease, it's sort of this whole package, right? Of sleep and circadian rhythms and stress and, or stress management and activity and nutrition. And so having one of those pieces not in place makes it really hard to have all of the other pieces in place. So it's a constant challenge to kind of keep everything together. But it does not require superpowers. And I like CrossFit. I also really like yoga. So I just laying that out there. Yoga's awesome.
Yoga and walking are usually, no matter what kind of health state that's, I mean, unless they're literally physically unable, those are really good kind of starting points for people. I have a side note for you that I've talked about in my other podcast that I'm like 108% sure that you don't listen to, which is totally fine. But for people who listen to both Strong Woman Radio and this podcast, I apologize that you're hearing it again. Anyway, did you know, did I tell you already, that there was a scientific study done where they had people stick their hand in a bucket of like freezing cold water, and they allowed one group to make noise and they allowed another group to not make noise and evaluated their pain tolerance level. Do you want to guess the outcome of this study?
I am 108% sure. You have brought this up on this podcast before.
Oh, well, this is why it's important that you're screaming when you're pushing the heavy weight up.
Did I tell you that they did that on Mythbusters? I'm pretty sure. Does that now bring this whole conversation back to you?
This is why I shouldn't have two podcasts, because I don't know what conversation I'm having where.
They did it on Mythbusters, and they did swearing versus like benign, like puppy dog type words.
Yeah.
And swear words increased pain tolerance.
Yeah. Well, as does yelling. So
as yelling, screaming, grunting, making noise, making my coach deaf.
Right. So it just makes you a better lifter. That's all.
But I'm actually, and that's why it's such a good gauge for me. but that's why it's
of
such
where
a good
the line
gauge
is,
for me,
yeah.
Of where the line is. So if I have to scream it up, and if I have to be vocal in order to get that last one or two or even three reps, that's where I'm drawing the line. So like I back squatted 160 pounds today and I managed five reps, and the last rep I had to like grunt to be able to stand all the way up. And that was like, okay, now I'm stopping. Like maybe I had one more, maybe I had two more, but I'm stopping at five, because that last one I was like, no, I'm not going to make the noise for everyone. But I was like, I was vocal, and that was like, okay, now I'm done. Like that for me was the line. And I probably should have recognized at four that I needed to stop at four, but sometimes I don't know until I'm like the bottom of a squat trying to push the weight back up again. Like, oh wait. Yeah. That last one would have been a good place to stop. And I don't drop the bar. So that was an option that I totally didn't consider at the time. Was like, I'll just grunt now and then I'll stop. But yeah, I think that for me with CrossFit, it's a constant evaluation of you know, should I go today? Should I take a rest day? How did I sleep? How am I feeling? How are my joints? How are my muscles? And sometimes, you know, for me, generally going 3 to 4 times a week seems to work really well. And what makes the difference between 3 and 4 times has a lot to do with my stress level and has a lot to do with the actual WODs and just how challenging they were for my body. But it's something I'm really enjoying getting back into. And I really, really missed when I was so sick in November and December. And definitely, definitely something that I love.
Awesome. Well, to be clear, Sarah and I like working out. If we tell you that science says that you shouldn't do it too much, it's not because we're curmudgeons that like to sit on the sofa. It's because that's what science says. And we just want everyone to be as healthy as they can be. And like all things in life, you could choose to work out more and have that be a life choice. Just like we know as a fact that shift work isn't great for your health, but people make that choice sometimes. And we know that birthday cake isn't the best thing in your life, but sometimes choose to make that. We're not here to judge you. We're not here to tell you what you're doing is, you know, making you a good person or a bad person, because that's not what we're trying to do. We're simply trying to inform everyone of the risks and benefits of some of these things in the event that you think that it is good to overexert and, you know, be aware of the possibility of injury and dysregulated hormones and adrenal fatigue and some of the things that we've talked about, because they can be very difficult to overcome if you're not mindful of them.
That was an excellent summary.
Excellent. Well, we'll be back next week, everybody. So have a great one.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
Okay. Apparently, I had accidentally hit my volume down button.
The make Stacey be quiet button.
It was. I didn't know that existed. It's so handy.
Ah, ha, ha. You're so funny.
I'm hoping. Matt, can you just cut out that, like, big gap?
I was, like, waiting. I was like, oh, God, is she going to not read that part?
Wait, I didn't scroll. So, Matt, I'm sorry. Cut point. You're going to have to make me not sound like an idiot right here.